Thank you for the introduction and the invitation to be here. So yes, I will tell you about quantum non-locality when one takes into account a sequence of experiments instead of the probabilities one obtains. And I will show you a few results we have on this.
So, can I ask where you're from? I didn't know what.
Yes, I'm from the Universidad de Buenos Aires in Argentina. Okay, so I will start by giving an extremely brief introduction to Kolmogorov complexity and algorithmic randomness. So I think most of you here are physicists, so you're probably not too familiar with all this. And then I will tell a little bit about Bell inequalities with pseudo-random inputs. Then I will try to ask the question is if nature can be at the same time non-local, computable, and non-signaling. This will be clear in a few minutes. Then I will show you a simple principle we can get to rule out many non-physical situations if we take into account sequences of experiments. And then I will try to give an idea on how to pursue a more geometric view on non-local correlations when one takes into account sequences. So the broad view is that we will be considering sequences of experiments in Bell-like scenarios instead of looking at the probabilities. Why are we interested in this? Because this first will give a broader view on quantum non-locality, because usually the experiments generate sequences of results, not probabilities. We see ones and zeros. And most of the times we only care about the probabilities and we discard the particular sequence we obtain. And I think there's a lot of information there that we can analyze and play with. And also using sequences allows us to avoid counterfactual arguments. When one analyzes probabilities, one is thinking that there could have been a different result to our experiment. That's an assumption. That's a counterfactual assumption. Usually what we obtain is a sequence. We don't know if something else could have happened from that experiment or not. Okay, so first I will start with a little bit on randomness and Kolmogorov complexity. So take these three strings, binary strings. Which of these is more likely to come from a fair coin tossing? I'm asking you. It's not a rhetorical question.
Second one, maybe?
Well, what's the probability of obtaining each one? It's 1/2 to the length of them. So the three are equally likely, right? Well, I did the experiment last night with a coin in my apartment. And I got one of these. Who thinks I got the first one? You two think I got the first one? That's another audience. The second one? Okay, and the third one? Okay, the second one is pi written in binary. So who still thinks I got the second one? So the three are equally likely, but somehow, when I ask you which one I got, you don't believe the three are equally likely. You all think it's the third one. Right? Or most of you, at least. There are two people who don't. So it seems more random. What does that mean? Well, the first two are comprehensible. We can give a meaning to them. The first one was 0, 1, 0, 1 repeated over and over. The second one was pi. But the third one, apparently, we cannot give any meaning to it. So in a sense, this roughly means that the first two are compressible, because I can tell you the name and you just know the whole sequence. And the third one is not. This notion of randomness, this intuitive notion we have on randomness, is the one captured by algorithmic randomness. It codifies this intuition. How much information does one need to give to a machine to produce a given string? Okay? If one has to provide as much information as the whole string, as the length of that string, then that string is random. So basically, the algorithmically random strings are the ones who are incompressible, okay, in the most general sense. And the ones that we can compress are not random. Okay? This is the intuition we have when two people raise their hands for the first sequence, and we all agree the third one was the most likely to arise from a fair coin tossing. So when we go to infinite sequences, we can still define a notion of randomness. It's not exactly compressibility because we cannot compress something infinite. But we can say that the sequence, when I say sequence, it's an infinite string, is algorithmically random if almost all of its prefixes are algorithmically random in this sense. I mean, I take the first 2 bits, the first 3, the first 4, and so on, and most of those finite strings are compressible. Okay? So that would mean that the infinite sequence is random. So now let's go to Kolmogorov complexity, the other notion I wanted to tell you about that we will use a bit in a few minutes. So the Kolmogorov complexity of a string, denoted by k of x, is the length of the shortest computer program that can generate that string. And it is defined up to an additive constant, which basically takes into account that you can have different computer languages or different computing models. But basically, it's the maximum compression you can give to a string. It's the shortest possible description in order for a machine to produce that string. So that's it. So now we can formally define what algorithmically randomness means. Basically, a sequence X is random if for almost all of its prefixes, it holds that the Kolmogorov complexity, I think. That's a pointer?
Like a trigger. You use your index like a trigger.
Trigger, okay, good. So if for almost all natural numbers n, the complexity of the first n bits of sequence x is roughly the length of the string. So the shortest program would be to give the whole string. Okay, so that would mean that it's random.
Very quick question.
Yes.
What do you mean by almost all f? Because there's no measure.
Okay, there are finitely many that are incompressible.
Okay. Does it make sense for finite sequences?
Yes, for finite sequences, you just take the definition that k of x, that k of x is roughly equal to the length of the string. Okay, that would be the notion of randomness. And there are two really nice results about this. The first one is that the Turing machine, which is basically a computer with infinite memory, cannot generate a random sequence. It's impossible for such a machine to generate a random sequence. And the second nice result related to this is that it's impossible to prove in any correct axiomatic system that a given string is random, but for finitely many strings. But for most of them, it's impossible to prove that they are random. You cannot have a theorem that says this string is random. And this is interesting because this basically means that we cannot measure randomness. If we do an experiment and we obtain a sequence, there's no way to certify that this is actually random in this sense because there's no way to prove it. Yes?
So just to clarify what that means, you're saying that in any axiomatic system, you can't prove a given string is random except for a subset of strings of which there are finitely many, and then you could prove they were random?
Yes. Okay. The whole idea is that given any axiomatic system, you could add one more axiom that says this string is random. So for finitely many, you can have those kind of axioms. And maybe you can prove it even without that kind of explicit axiom. But for
so if we turn it around, I could prove that, let's say, 1,000 strings were random, but then you could think of another one that within my axiomatic scheme I could never know.
Well, I cannot prove that another one is random within that axiomatic system.
You wouldn't know if it were.
Yeah, that's it.
He would have a hard time constructing it because he can't.
Sorry?
He would have a hard time constructing the example because he can't program a computer to generate that.
And you can, and even if you construct it, you cannot prove that it's random. So I cannot give you an example of a random string on a given axiomatic system. Of course, if you take just the bit 0 or the bit 1 as a string of length 1, those are random. Those are trivially random in, I think, any or almost any axiomatic system. But in general, you cannot prove it. Actually, this proof that it's impossible to prove that a given string is random. It's really nice. If we have time at the end, I can tell you how to prove that, which is really, really beautiful. OK. So some notation I will denote by x, y, and z, strings or sequences, depending on the context. X harpoon n refers to the first n symbols from a sequence x. And if I have x and y sequences or strings, by x plus y, I mean alternating bits from each of the sequences. The reason for this, I wanted to concatenate strings. That can be done for strings, but not for infinite sequences. So the way to do it for infinite sequences is to alternate one bit from each one. OK, and the final notion we need, and then we'll get into non-locality, is this idea of normalized information distance, which basically tells us the distance between two strings in terms of the Kolmogorov complexity. It's just a distance measure that gives us zero if the two strings are the same, and one if they are completely independent. What I mean by independent is that the shortest program that can compute one having free access to the other is the same as without having free access to the other. Okay? That means independent in this context. And that's what I'm noting by k of y given x is the shortest program that outputs y that can have free access to the bits from x. Okay? It's usually referred as an oracle for x. Okay, so we have this extremely brief introduction to sequences, Kolmogorov complexity, and randomness. Now let's see what we can say about non-locality by studying sequences of experiments. So the first result I'm going to tell you about is a loophole for Bell inequalities. This was work in collaboration with Gonzalo de la Torre and Antonio Asin from Barcelona, and Gabriel Seno and Santiago Figueira from Buenos Aires. Now Gabriel Seno is in Barcelona. I was in Barcelona first, and then in Buenos Aires I moved. OK. So first, let's define a Bell scenario in non-locality. We have, on the simplest case, I will always see on this simplest case, two boxes. Each box has a binary input, that is two buttons, and a binary output, two lights. And we will say that this gives local correlations if the probability of obtaining A and B, given that the inputs were X and Y, I'm talking about single shots, like probabilities here, is a convex combination of probabilities for Alice and for Bob. That would mean that it gives local correlations. In any other case, these correlations will be called non-local. And we have Bell inequalities of this kind that basically are cannot be violated by any local distribution, but can be violated by some non-local distributions. And quantum mechanics allows for violations of some of these Bell inequalities. Okay? That's all we need to know for this. So what we will analyze here is what happens when the inputs for the Bell experiment, instead of being random sequences for Alice and for Bob, are pseudo-random. So the reason for this is that they cannot prove that what they are doing is random, for the reason I told you before. So at most, they can certify that it's pseudo-random. And also, pseudo-random is something that can be generated by computers and stuff like that. Okay? So what happens when we go into this? So we will go to the memory scenario, in which we introduce an eavesdropper that prepares the boxes locally after each round with knowledge from what happened on the previous rounds and uses those boxes to try to violate the Bell inequality. Okay? So basically, after first round, this eavesdropper gets the results and the inputs from the previous round, prepares the boxes for the next round, local boxes, and then again, you have Alice and Bob using these new boxes. Then again, the eavesdropper prepares with all the previous knowledge from the previous rounds and so on. Okay? I will show you that these models, if the inputs are pseudo-random, can violate the Bell inequality. So they look non-local, although they are local. So the whole idea is that if the eavesdropper can start predicting the input bits from Alice or Bob, it can, of course, prepare local boxes that will behave on the next round in a way that looks non-local. Okay? So the whole thing is how to predict the bits from the input sequences. So this problem is basically the one that is known as learnability of infinite sequences from prefixes. If after seeing many bits from these infinite sequences, it can start predicting correctly all the forthcoming ones. And this problem has already been studied from some 20, 30 years ago by Solomonov, Gold, Zugman independently. And the main result is that any time or space-bounded complexity class can be learned from prefixes. What is a time-bounded or space-bounded complexity class? All these classes we know, P, NP, okay? All those classes are, these are actually time-bounded complexity classes. And the algorithm to learn from prefixes, it's actually quite simple. The whole idea is that these classes are computably enumerable, which means that the computer can list them one after the other, all the sequences from that class. So basically, to predict the forthcoming bits, the algorithm works as follows. If it has seen these first bits, it looks for the first bits of all the sequences until it finds it for the first time. And then the guess for the next one will be the next bit it has there. Of course, for this to work, we need to assume that the sequence Alice or Robo we're using belongs to some class, which is the class we are learning, okay? So how do we ensure that it will learn the sequence, the proper sequence? Well, basically, as the sequence we are trying to learn belongs to this class, it will be somewhere on this list, okay? And with this protocol, we only move forward on this list. And once we reach the proper sequence, we stay there, okay? So we can guarantee that this will start predicting correctly after a while. We don't know how long it takes, but it's finite time, okay? So the two results related to this is that if Alice and Bob use computable functions for their pseudo-random inputs, they of course belong to some complexity class, because every computable function belongs to some time complexity class. So they cannot rule out an eavesdropper learning a class bigger than the one they are using, therefore starting to predict correctly and faking their boxes, okay? There's no way for them to do that as long as they use pseudo-random inputs, which is the only thing that they can prove to have. On the other hand, from the eavesdropper perspective, by choosing the class the eavesdropper is learning, he's forcing Alice and Bob to have to use harder to generate sequences. For instance, if the eavesdropper is learning the class NP, Alice and Bob would have to go beyond NP to more difficult classes that take more time to generate in order to show a violation of Abel inequality. Okay, so that eavesdropper can force them into doing extremely hard things. Of course, having enough power. So of course, there's an overhead on this because learning a class requires a little more computing power, but it's not such a big overhead because once the sequence is learned, to predict the forthcoming bits doesn't take the eavesdropper more time than the one Alice and Bob needed to generate it. So there's no big overhead on this. So the eavesdropper basically has the same computing power, just a bit more than Alice and Bob. So this was the first result I wanted to tell you. The second one, again, part of the same collaboration, is a question if nature can be at the same time non-local, computable, and non-signaling. Okay, what do we mean by this? For this result, we consider this sort of models in which the boxes for Alice and Bob used to generate non-locality, some sort of hidden signaling. What's a hidden signaling? It's signaling between the boxes that cannot be used by Alice and Bob to signal a message. Just the boxes are using some mechanism which is internal to nature to generate non-locality, but it still cannot be used. So the output will be a function that takes into account both inputs in order to be non-local and some round number. So for each round, it's like a different function, okay? And the same goes for Bob. So of course, the functions A and B depend on the other party's input because it's the only thing that makes sense to signal between the boxes because the rest is compute. We will assume that it's computable. So it makes no sense to signal it because they can compute it locally. So if we don't assume that the functions are computable, this can perfectly simulate quantum mechanics. It's just the output on round n given inputs x and y. However, we will assume functions A and B to be computable, because this is a reasonable feature for these models that are kind of classical. So as we assume that the box is shown on local correlations, that means that in infinitely many rounds, both output will depend non-trivially on Alice's input, because otherwise the correlations they see are local. So if the correlations are non-local, this has to happen for infinitely many rounds. So if somehow Bob could knew what his box is doing, could knew the function his box is calculating, he could guess Alice's input from these rounds. Okay? But of course, this is something that nature does in private, so he cannot know that function. But again, he can use learnability to try to learn his box's function. Okay? So the whole protocol to learn the function Bob's box is using and signal will be the following. Alice and Bob will pre-share a random sequence over this alphabet. So the alphabet has binary pairs and numbers from 1 to m, m being the length of the message they want to signal. It's difficult to say what it means to share a random sequence because that requires infinite information, but I will remove this requisite later on, so we won't need it to be random. But first, let's try with random sequences. So this random sequence has two types of rounds. If S of n, the nth symbol from the sequence, is a binary pair, they will use that round for learning purposes. So Alice will input x, the x given by the pair. Bob will input y, the y given by that pair that they shared. And they will use that round, or Bob will use that round and his output to try to predict, in the same way as before, what function his box is computing. On the other hand, if S of n equals a number from 1 to m, the rest of the alphabet, Alice will input the corresponding bit of her message. And Bob will use his current knowledge on the function B, his guess for B after the so many learning rounds, to try to predict Alice's input. Okay? Because for infinitely many rounds this happens, so he will try to use it to predict Alice's input. Okay? So the thing is that since after finite amount of rounds, we can ensure with this that Bob will learn what his box is doing, the statistics on Alice's message after a long number of runs will be enough to know what Alice is trying to send in finite time, okay? Because he's predicting correctly after a while every bit from the message. So the first ones are noise, but then after a while he's predicting correctly. So what happens when Bob's guess for B is wrong? This will happen for finite time. Well, the randomness of the sequence S will be the one that ensures us that at some point he will realize he's wrong. He will have a learning round in which his prediction will be different from what his box outputs because S is random, and therefore he will move on the list of sequences from the class he's using. So sooner or later, this ensures that the function B will be learned. So now the question I asked before, is it fair to allow for Alice and Bob to use randomness? What does it mean to pre-share a random sequence? And that's infinite information. Can they use randomness if we are assuming that even nature is not random? So let's remove this randomness prerequisite for this. So we will try to use a non-random sequence S. If sequence S was too simple, for instance, alternating all the symbols all over again and something like this, then the program used by Bob's box could be computing that sequence S and having different strategies for learning rounds, because the box will know when Alice and Bob are having learning rounds, and for signaling rounds. Therefore, what they are learning is useless for the learning rounds. So it has to be a bit more complex than what the boxes are doing. So how complex should it be, assuming that Bob's box belongs to some complexity class C? That's the question. And the interesting results on this are the notion of C-randomness, in which we call a sequence S C-random if no adversary with computing power belonging to a class C can bet on the next symbol from S and win an unbounded amount of money. So it's random to an adversary with limited computing power. So there's a result that says that there exist computable C-random sequences. So a computer can generate C-random sequences given the class that he wants to defeat. So basically, for our problem, is the sequence S that they pre-share was C-random, and Bob's box computes a function belonging to class C, the protocol will still be sound without using any randomness. So Alice will be able to signal Bob in the limit after some time. She will be able to signal. So the protocol is basically the same, but instead of pre-sharing a random sequence, they pre-share a C-random sequence for the class they assume Bob's box belong to. And as long as that assumption is correct, they will be able to signal. And now it's easy to see what we mean by pre-sharing a C-random sequence. To pre-share a C-random sequence is to pre-share a computer program, so a finite computer program that generates that sequence. So that's easy to do. It's finite information. Okay? The rest of the protocol works the same. So basically, what we've shown here is that non-signaling deterministic models for non-local correlations have to be uncomputable. So there has to be something uncomputable. Okay, so basically, computable boxes that resort to hidden signaling are not physical boxes. So now, talking about non-physical situations, okay, I'm good on time. We'll tell you a simple principle that rules out many of these non-physical situations that we just saw. Again, related to sequences and complexities and all that. So we are all familiar with this, although this is a bit different from the common one. We have the local polytope, the quantum set of correlations, and the non-signaling polytope. I guess we've all heard of this. So we will fix the inputs to be algorithmically random sequences, X and Y, and see how to propose a principle that rules out many non-physical situations. So what do I mean by situations? Imagine that we have P of AB given XY equals to 1/4. That's noise. That's basically noise for both boxes. So when we look at realizations of that noise, at sequences of experiments, it could be that A and B, the output sequences for Alice and Bob, are random sequences independent from each other. We can write this as A plus B plus X plus Y, so alternating bits from the four sequences is still random. This means that the four of them are random and independent. But we can have another situation that when we look at relative frequencies to try to calculate the probabilities, it gives the same result but is signaling, which is this situation. Take A random and independent from X and Y, but take the sequence B to be a zero followed by X, followed by Alice's input. So when they look at relative frequencies, they will still see 1/4, because since we shifted the X for B, it will look completely uncorrelated. However, this is clearly signal. I mean, Bob's output is exactly Alice's input with a zero before it. So it's clearly signaling. So this second solution is not the physical solution or at least it's not something that we would expect to get. Okay? Or we can take another example in which we have P of AB given XY is something non-local, whatever thing non-local. So if A and B are sequences obtained from an experiment done in a lab or being quantum predictions and everything, this is, of course, non-signaling. But if A and B are computable, as in the result I mentioned 2 minutes ago, then they would be able to signal with that protocol I've shown, right? So this last solution gives the same P. It still, when we look at relative frequencies, appears to be this P of AB given XY equals to that non-local thing, but still allows for Alice to signal to Bob. So this is, again, not a physical realization of that experiment. So our simple principle to rule out this many non-physical sequences of experiments would be the following. Given a probability P of AB given XY and random sequences, random independent sequences for the inputs, we will say that only sequences A and B, such that X plus Y plus A plus B is as random as possible, are the one allowed by nature. Okay, so nature will only allow to have outputs that are as random and as independent as possibly compatible with P. Okay? So let's take, for example, the case in which A was random and independent from everything, but B was equal to 0x. When we take x plus y plus a plus b, okay, this is clearly compressible because this information is the same as this one. Okay? So we can obviously compress that to 3/4 of the length if everything else is random. But if b was also random and independent from everything, we wouldn't be able to compress these four sequences. Okay? So this is ruling out that example in which both output was just a shifted version of Alice's input. Again, the same goes if A and B were computable. Computable sequences are highly compressible because an infinite sequence can be compressed to a finite program. Okay? So again, this x plus y plus a plus b in the case of A and B computable would be compressible. So it wouldn't be as random as possible. So this principle rules that out. So how to formalize this? The idea to formalize this is that given P and a fixed random sequence like x plus y for the inputs, there exist A prime and B prime such that for all A and B yielding the same P as relative frequencies, this holds. In the limit, the Kolmogorov complexity of whatever sequences we have for A and B that yield P is less or equal than 1 when divided by the one for this A prime and B prime. So A prime and B prime are the most random that can be done with that, are the ones that have the most possible amount of information compatible with B and X and Y. So the principle states that nature only allows for sequences such that this equality holds. So all the allowed sequences will have exactly the same amount of information as the most random ones compatible with that P and with X and Y. Okay? So this will be the way to state that principle. So there's something that this principle doesn't do as an informational principle. It doesn't rule out any point inside the non-signaling polytope. What it does is for every point on the non-signaling polytope, it says that some realizations are physical and some are not. But it doesn't rule out any point. Okay, it rules out some possible sequences yielding each probability. But of course, I believe that there could be principles involving sequences way more interesting than this one that actually rule out points from the non-signaling polytope. And this principle is a bit like the IID assumption when working with probabilities. The IID assumption, if each round is independent, we expect it to be as random as possible. There are no correlations between the previous round. The difference is that here we don't need to talk about independence, which is a counterfactual property, something that assumes that it's a probability. Okay, so finally, I will show you a little bit about non-locality and non-signaling for strings of experiments. I think I can do this in some 5 minutes. So there's one definition of non-signaling involving strings that was given by Wolf in his paper called Non-Locality Without Counterfactual Reasoning. He basically defines non-signaling for strings in terms of relative Kolmogorov complexities by these two equations. Basically, the complexity of Alice's string doesn't decrease by knowing Bob's input. So having knowledge on the input from Bob's box doesn't help you compute the output from Alice's box. That's what he defines as non-signaling, which is a reasonable way to define non-signaling. It actually rules out this case in which Bob's output was shifted from Alice's input. And the same for Bob. Okay? Knowing the input from the other box doesn't help that box compute its output. If we assume independence of the boxes, this recovers the usual notion of non-signaling. But without assuming it, we can still say that this doesn't allow to send any information. How can we define non-locality when talking about strings? In that same paper, the definition he gives is that if there exists a string lambda, which will be the hidden variables for the local model, such that lambda is independent from the inputs, this states that it's independent from the inputs. So knowing lambda doesn't help compute x and y. I think this was a plus. I'm not sure. Maybe there's a mistake there. Anyway. Such that lambda trivializes Alice's output and Bob's output with their input. So basically, Alice's box can compute the output knowing x and lambda, and Bob's box can compute the output knowing y and lambda. Okay? So this would be a notion of locality. The problem with this definition of locality and non-signaling is that it lacks a geometric structure, as we have the polytope and we have things that are more non-local than others and stuff like that, or things more local than others, which would be nice to recover in order to have such statements that this situation is the most non-local one or stuff like that. So we propose a way to move forward in that direction to define a notion of order or something like that when it comes to sequences and non-locality and non-signaling. So basically, we can rewrite these two notions as this. AB and XY are local if there exists an omega independent from X and Y, such as this holds. This is the same as before, it was with lambda. But we can rewrite non-signaling if we consider an omega equals to X plus Y, so it has all the information from X and Y, such that this omega doesn't help compute each output from each box. This is basically giving Alice Bob's input and giving Bob Alice's input. So with these two that look pretty similar, these two definitions, here it's zero and here it's k of a given x, we can give a notion, which is a function that depends on parametrically on a, b, x, y, and depends on sequence omega, that basically includes the independence between omega and x and y in order to reflect that here we need omega independent and here we need omega completely dependent on x and y. And then it has how much omega helps me compute Alice's output from its input and Bob's output from the input. So basically with this quantity here, what we have is the minimum over omega of this quantity eta would be zero if and only if a, b, x, and y are local. And the maximum over omega of this eta will be one if and only if a, b, x, and y are non-signaling. So basically the range of this function eta will tell us how non-local something is or how non-signaling something is. So we have something like a way to quantify non-signaling. Of course, the problem with all this is that it's not computable, because this eta, even for a fixed omega, it's not computable because it involves Kolmogorov complexities, which are not computable, only can be approximated. And even with that, we need to minimize or maximize over infinite sequences. So this is, of course, not computable. That doesn't mean nature is not doing something like this. That we cannot compute it, that doesn't mean that that doesn't properly represent what happens on an experiment. But the good thing is that in some particular cases, I believe this can be calculated. For instance, when we take independence between the rounds, I think this is possible to be calculated. Okay, so as a summary of everything we've seen about sequences for Bell experiments, first we saw a loophole that happens whenever Alice and Bob use pseudo-random inputs instead of random inputs. The only assumption for the local model is a knowledge on the time or space complexity bound of the inputs they are using. And they cannot rule out the local model generating the non-local correlations they see whenever they use pseudo-random inputs. Then we analyze what happens if nature behaved in a computable way, resorting to hidden signaling to generate non-locality. And we saw that if that was the case, that hidden signaling could be extracted by Alice and Bob to signal a message. Then we introduce a really simple principle that by analyzing sequences of experiments rules out many non-physical ones. That was that nature only allows, given a probability P and inputs X and Y, the A and B that are as random as possible compatible with that. And this rules out many non-physical situations, such as the ones from this example, having computable boxes for Alice and Bob. And finally, we provided a unified way to quantify locality and non-signaling when talking about sequences, which, although it's not computable, might be useful when we try to analyze sequences of experiments. So thank you. And just short announcement, if you want, there's a statement towards gender balance in meetings for the quantum community. If you want to sign, you can look in Twitter there. Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions?
So you had this measure of complexity of these local and non-local correlations towards the end.
Yeah.
This is the thing here. Do you have any idea if you this set of quantum correlations, what this would be?
For quantum correlations?
Yeah. Or
well, the minimum has to be bigger than one. This goes between 0 and 1 for any sequences. So it has to move the minimum over 0, and the maximum has to be in 1 because they are still non-signaling. So the range has to move the lower value higher, but I don't know how much up higher it can go. So maybe that would be a good bound to look for quantum correlations.
I guess you could also turn the question on its head, because it seems like this is a natural way measuring the complexity of local and non-signaling. But maybe there's another one that's natural for quantum correlations. Like just kind of rearranging.
There could be. The problem is that whenever you talk about quantum, the first thing you assume when you say quantum is independence between the rounds. So, of course, you can try to work this out when you have independence. I think in that case, this should probably be computable, even the probabilities. But you lose all this non-counterfactual thing that is interesting here. But still, it's a question we are interested in, what happens with quantum correlations.
So when you were proposing this principle to rule out non-physical sequences,
yes.
It seems like the motivation, at least, you're trying to kind of rule out some kind of fine-tuning scenarios. Can you think of this principle as kind of ruling out some fine-tuning, some notion of fine-tuning?
So fine-tuning as a dependence between the inputs and the hidden variables, or?
Yeah, so there is some kind of dependence, but nevertheless, you could have some other sequences, A primed and B primed, which are independent and still give you the same, you know, same probabilities.
So A prime and B prime, not independent, you mean, from each other?
Well, here...
Yes. Here, I'm not saying that they are independent.
OK, but they're as independent as possible.
As possible, in the sense that when you take A plus B are as random as possible with X and Y.
So you are ruling out the possibility that they are kind of more dependent than they could be?
Yes.
Maybe not always, but maybe in some scenarios you can think of as some kind of fine-tuning.
Yes. For instance, I think that if you have a hidden variable that repeats itself, for instance, it's 1, 0, 1, 0, and so on, then this wouldn't hold.
Okay.
Because they won't be as random as possible. You can think of boxes that their outputs are 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0 all the time with that kind of hidden variable model, which won't obey this principle, I think. But when we try to reproduce the quantum ones, we think of a state and measurement operators, so we try to go for independence of rounds.
So the idea of a sequence of suddenly makes sense if you imagine doing one bell experiment followed by another. So in time, you could imagine instead doing sort of many different bell experiments simultaneously.
Yes.
Across a distributed in three-dimensional space, then it would be clear how to index the sequence that you thought about. That kind of shift.
No, we haven't thought about that. That's, if I'm not wrong, like having every possible permutation between the experiments, right? Maybe it's...
I mean, you could imagine some ordering because if you build a finite volume of space, then some positions would be preferred.
Yeah, I think if you go to the infinite limit, I mean, in which you have infinite experiments done simultaneously, I believe that there's always an ordering which will give you really simple things that will violate this. Even if you take like a truly quantum experiment, there's a reordering of the experiments that will give you really simple things in terms of complexity.
The point is that reordering might not be computed. So if you start with some ordering, which might be just start at one geographic location, then put the nearest ones, nearest experiment, then you would expect that the reorderings that make your sequences simple are going to be computed.
Well, it depends. It's really simple to think of these reorderings once you know the results from the experiment. So with respect to the results of the experiments, it's computable and simple.
Sure, but if you have to stay in the ordering.
Yeah, otherwise it's not. Yeah, I don't know when you take all simultaneously, what would be a reasonable way to order them in order to talk about computability of that or not. I don't think of any.
Can you go back a little bit to the that kind of?
You tell me.
You introduced the signaling between the boxes and assumed computability.
Maybe here.
So here, when you say that A and B are computable, is that the same sense in which the sequence that A and B share is computable?
Yeah. What it means computable? Maybe I wasn't too clear about that. When we say that the function is computable. When there exists a program that, given the inputs, gives the output. That's what I mean by computable. Of course, thinking of functions or sequences is the same because it's functions from the naturals into the naturals. So function or sequence is the same. But yeah, it's in that sense. There exists a program that generates B given X, Y, and N.
And now then you have this C randomness.
Yes.
So that's with respect to some computational class.
Yes.
Is that arbitrary or?
Given any time or space bounded complexity class, there is a C-random computable sequence with respect to that class. Yes, for any class.
But moreover, you said it's computable. So this
yes.
The C-random sequence is computable.
It's a bit harder than that class to compute, but it's still computable. I don't remember the details on how to generate it, but basically the whole idea was that you have that C class, you list all the sequences, and by a Cantor diagonal argument, you can just generate one sequence that it's neither of those. So it goes something like this to obtain that one.
I guess this is a follow-up question. You mentioned that in order for Alice to sort of utilize the same signaling, the C random sequence that they share has to be the same class, C class, as B's function, or Bob's function.
No, it has to be C random with respect to the class to which this belongs. Right. So the whole thing goes like this. Alice and Bob assume that the box is computing something that belongs to some class C.
Right.
Then they share a C random class for that, a C random sequence for that class.
Yeah.
And then the protocol will allow them to signal. If they miss and pick a class smaller than the one the box is using, they won't be able to signal.
Right. So is there some small modification to the protocol which might, in addition to learning the nature of the function, also the class?
No, because it can be proven that the class of all the total computable functions is not learnable. So no, they need to assume some class.
Any further questions? Okay, that's